Hello, this is Jeanette Lafeve, your guest host tonight on the People Speak Radio, filling in for Bassem Farhat. At the People Speak, we believe the voices and actions of ordinary people make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak at bbsradio.com, live every Tuesday night from 8:55 to 9:55 p.m. Eastern Time. You can also log into our website at peoplespeakradio.com to listen to us live, join us through our live chat on Pal Talk, or listen to the archives of previous shows. We broadcast 1 hour live to the USA, the United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia. If you have questions for our guest, you can call 415-762-1160 or 712-432-0075, access number 318-116. You can also listen and call via your smartphone, so you never have to miss the best guest on internet radio. Tonight I'm live with a very dear friend of mine, George McMahon, who is one of the four surviving federal medical marijuana patients. I'm not going to go into a lot of background detail. I'll let George explain this all to you himself. Hi, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening. I'm doing pretty good.
Okay. Something that I've never asked you about, George, is how did you get into the IND program in the first place? What made you realize marijuana would be good medicine for your condition?
Well, that started about 1988. I had been in the University of Iowa hospitals for about 2 years, and pretty much every day. I mean, I was living there, almost. And he was going to school, and he was a nurse's either assistant or an aide. I'm not quite sure of his position. Came in to me and said, you know, there's a cancer patient. Well, first he asked me what the tattoo of my arm was, and I have a zigzag man there that I've had for years. And I told him, and he said, that's what I thought. Well, he said, there's a patient down the hallway who's dying of cancer. And at that point, I was considered dead. They told me to get my paperwork together that I was never going to go home. And in fact, by then, we're telling me I wasn't going to live through the night. And this kid walked in. Well, he wasn't a kid. He was in his mid-20s. Said that to me and said he would trade you one marijuana cigarette for one tobacco cigarette. He won't be alive much longer, but he wants to smoke a cigarette. And by then I hadn't smoked a cigarette, and I hadn't eaten any food, I hadn't smoked any cigarettes, I hadn't drank any water or anything in quite a few weeks. And I said, well, take them all. And I had a couple cartons sitting in my drawer. He said, no, just one. So about 9 o'clock that night, he came back and gave me a joint. I suspect to this day that it was a government joint. I don't know. And I smoked it, and about 15 minutes later, I was asking for food. They kind of got pretty excited because I hadn't been able to eat, I was in pretty bad shape. By the time the night was over, I'd eaten. I couldn't eat beef and protein. That just completely made me ill, but I had eaten huge bowls of raw vegetables. Well, I knew something was different, and the next morning I got up feeling good enough to tell all my doctors. By then I had 10 departments at a university hospital caring for me. So I started telling them I wanted to go home. And they made the deal with me that when I could walk to all their offices, I could go home. I went home 10 days later. So that was the beginning of my search. And at that point, I knew it was medicine. It was good medicine for me. I smoked one joint, and I came back from the dead. And I couldn't get any when I got out of the hospital. I live in north central Iowa. There's not a lot of pond up here, but there's a lot of ditch weed up here. And so I thought, well, I'll try that, and it worked. And at that point, by then, I was already talking to a doctor. He had said, I want to see how you react without any. After just this one joint, I said, I'm not doing that. So he went ahead and filled out the paperwork, and he said, okay, now will you do it? And this is a period of 3 or 4 months that he kind of waited and watched me to see what was happening, and I was becoming very addicted to very strong meds again, and I was getting worse. And his answer to that was he filed the papers and told me. And the end result was I got into the program under the auspices of my medical needs, I never had to sue the government. I simply approached them with the facts, and they allowed me into the program. At that point, there was 15 of us allowed. There was 15 of us shipped medicine. There was 56 eventually approved, but only the 15 of us were ever supplied. So they,
why were people approved and never supplied with medicine?
They got a letter from Dr. Spiker. I've forgotten his first name, but they got a letter from a Dr. Spiker, who was at that time head general in the health department. And he just wrote him a letter and said, well, we don't think it works, so you're not getting it. We're closing the program. Of course, it's an investigative new drug program. They didn't close the program. All they did was just stop supplying or stop paying any attention to any studies or anything that might prove them wrong and stop letting people have it.
Okay, now, once you've started in the program, now I know this number. How much is the government supplying you with? And it's always been the same amount, correct?
Yep, it's always been the same amount. They supply me with about a half a pound a month. Well, it's supposed to be a half a pound a month, but they already have rolled it. And it turns out their very cleanest is not real clean, so I have to take stems and seeds out of it. And it's also very, very dry. They freeze dry it and then keep it that way for, mine's 10 years old. So when I get it, I have to moisturize it and remove the paper. It's a palm oil rolling paper. They do it in an old palm oil rolling machine into that length of paper. And it's like, kind of like lighting a burning rag. You don't even want to be in the same house with it until it's got moisture and the seeds and the stems have been taken out of it. So I actually don't get the half pound a month. But over the years, I've begun smoking less. So now my half pound, instead of lasting a month, might last 6 weeks.
Okay. Okay, and now you've explained to me the science behind that, why as a patient, that the longer you smoke it, the less you require.
Sure, the better I learn how to. One thing marijuana isn't doing is it isn't filling up any of the keyways, the receptors for your pain relief. It's not just covering them up. It's actually teaching them how to react. So it's like the key that's almost right, but not quite. You know, it's the same thing that's in your body already. Well, it slips into the keyway it's supposed to, and you have to learn how to turn it. It takes a little while longer to do it that way, but pretty soon you're controlling what's going on in your body, not your body controlling you. You don't have to take drugs to keep it, make it do what you want it to do. You have to think about it. And that's of course, partially because of the purines and other compounds and buffers that are mixed in with the plant itself. So you end up with a much better understanding of oneself. You know, one of the oldest sayings about pot is it opens your eyes. Well, it makes you understand yourself better. That's true. It does have physical effects, but they're not the ones that the opioids or the synthetics are using. It doesn't, as a rule, affect any of those same keyways.
Now, after you discovered marijuana as medicine and were given access to a medication that, as you said, only 15 patients have been supplied by the federal government, you could have said, okay, I'm getting better and I'm happy and I'm going to get on with my life, but I know you well enough and I know that's not what you've done, that since you've gained access to this medicine, you've pretty much put a great deal of time and effort into helping everyone have access to this medicine. Where did you start? When did you start your public advocacy to help others get access to what was saving your life?
Probably, let's see, my first public appearance was 1990. As soon as I got the medicine, I threw away the opioids, and I had a lot of them. And within a matter of a month, maybe 6 weeks, I was already out talking to senators and going to rallies and just trying to stop the argument. You know, what the thing about me is I'm normal. I think every American, every human would do this for any other human if they really believed it worked. I do. I'm sure it works. So, you know, I can't see any reason for them to stop it. And because of that, I have to keep continuing trying to help other people. It doesn't help me anymore. I'm safe. Well, I'm, you know, probably nobody's safe, but I'm not in the same fix that a lot of my friends are. For instance, time. And that's a real hard spot to be. Part of the problem that's going on is we have 14 states that have legalized, and they have the right to do that under the states' rights laws, which specifically at the federal level have been exempted about scheduling of drugs. So the state can schedule the drug wherever it wants. However, once it does that, if it's different than the DEA scheduling, you have to make them, the state, not me or you, we can't even do it. But the state has to go, and by laws, has to go to the federal government and say, here, we did this, now you do it. But so far, nobody's done that. And that's what we're trying to get done now. One of the things is it's got to be for all of us, not just for me and you, and the few others that are, and in really, in reality, when you strip, and there's a lot of criminality in it right now, there's a lot of money in it. When you strip that from it, there's still a lot of people that need the help.
I've heard you mention in the discussions, in many, many discussions, when you said that it should be for everybody, not just me and you. You extend that as a rule to the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause.
Absolutely. That is the whole basis of my feelings about it. If I have that right, so do you.
Okay. Now, we were talking about the various states that have legalized, and my state is one that has legalized. But under federal law, while as a federal patient, the DEA is not going to come and pick you up for carrying a half a pound, or even several pounds, state patients aren't protected to that degree. They can still, at the whim of the DEA or the federal government, although Obama has said that they are not prosecuting people for medical use, they still can do so.
Go ahead.
But within the states, we don't have the same level of protection that you have.
No, not yet. We did hear today, we've gotten some reports back on the Getman. Forgotten what you call the legal movement. He filed on the DEA to change the scheduling, and they're still ruling on paperwork that they got in 1996, and they're saying they just don't have the new paperwork from 1996 on. They just don't have it yet. They don't have it done yet. They're looking at it. Well, it's been since 1996 they've been looking at it. So, we're in a drag it out as long as we can. Many people suffering, but it seems to be the people doing the dragging aren't. You know, they're sitting around. If they want a joint, they know where to go get it. And, of course, few of them do a joint. Most of them do whiskey and morphine and a lot of other really questionable drugs. Hallucinogens so powerful I wouldn't dream of taking one. But these people take them, and then they make up rules for what we can take and can't take. It's pretty strange. And today the announcement was that they're still making... They're going to deny it, the rescheduling on the 96 information, but they're still working on the new. We'd be up to 2002 is all they've accepted so far. That's how far behind they are. It's going to take a lot of people, and it's going to take a lot of sick people stepping up and saying, you know what, I'm wearing tennis shoes because I don't have money to buy $400 loafers. I'm wearing a heavy parka that looks a little bit old because I can't go buy a new coat this year. And, you know, I'm not going to let you hold it against me. And those are the folks that are going to have to stand up, you and me.
Okay. This is something I haven't told the producer of our show yet, but in Michigan, my state, legalized medical marijuana almost 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years in November. They implemented a year ago in April. And I'm also a medical marijuana patient, but only at the state level. I don't have the level of federal protection that you have. Now, One of the things that I know you've done over the years is the establishment of patients out of time. Multiple issues there. One, to get people educated on marijuana as medicine. And the other one was to educate the public on the kind of people that would benefit from medical marijuana. We're not a bunch of old hippies looking for an excuse to get high, essentially. Now, to tie into that, I have a real quick question here from the audience, from Stephen, Rhode Island. It recently came to my attention that clinical studies done in 1974 demonstrated that properties in marijuana actually cure cancer. Would you consider this an act of suppression of vital information by the U.S. government?
I would, yes. I'm familiar not only with the study, I'm familiar with a living patient. It's one of the four patients still living. He has a rheumatoid tumor disease. It's a cancer. He grows tumors inside of his bones. They grow so big they break his legs, his bone. And they'll put splinters of bone right out through the muscle in his leg. But since he started smoking marijuana, all the tumors they had when he started disappeared, and he's had no new ones. And that's 25 years.
Okay, and that was, is this the patient I'm thinking of, Mr. Rosenfeld? He's an amazing man himself, because I've seen you both do interviews, and you're both founding members of the Board of Patient Out of Time. Now, can you tell us what's the purpose of Patient Out of Time? What is it that you, the patient, hope to accomplish?
It was actually two organizations. It was Patients Out of Time, which was just patients, and that was an informal organization. There was no paperwork on it. It was a pretty large group of people. And there was the eye care group, which was the doctors who were working on the problem from their end. And we came together, and the name that came together as the most omnipotent was Patients Out of Time. So we assembled a host of doctors to be able to explain, show the studies, find the studies. I mean, they're all over out there. They're just buried. And when you put the two together, look what we've got. We've got 14 states, and, you know, Patients Out of Time came together. Let's see, Carl and I started using that terminology in 1990. That's where I started using it. And probably by 95, I think, we had an organization. That might have been a little after that, before we got all the qualifications for the organization together. It's a 503c nonprofit, and it is to get the information that we know is there, get other doctors interested in studying us, people, humans, who have these problems that are solved by marijuana, and to get them to publish and to talk to the patients and other doctors and other healthcare. And I think we've done wonderful at that, patients and doctors both.
Yes, I've gone to your website, the Patients Out of Time website, and checked the studies there, and is it something like the most complete compilation of studies on medical marijuana?
Yes, ever.
Available.
We've got everybody. Yep. Mesalum to, sorry, go ahead.
Also, there is a list over the years, you know, when you first started with this, most people did not believe in marijuana as medicine. And over the years, you've seen one organization after another sign on board. Would you like to just list a few of them? And the most recent and most surprising?
The AMA. The AMA has climbed on board. I don't know who you might mean. There's been a bunch of them. The American Medical Association was probably the big one that just recently claimed, our president just recently admitted that it has medical use in his mind. God, I can't even think. You did me time.
Well, I've seen the nursing associations on there, the American College of Physicians.
Nursing Association and the American College of Physicians have both been with us since almost the beginning.
And the list is growing every day as more and more people. And it's because you and the early patients that were protected under law and didn't have to worry that by speaking out you made yourselves targets for prosecution.
Very true. We knew we were targets anyway.
Yeah, to some degree, but safer than the rest of us who, the minute
Absolutely.
We smoke up and go, I smoke weed to take care of my seizures, they go, uh-huh, now we start watching you. But,
yep.
But in fact, that in those early days, you say there's only 15 patients that have ever been supplied with medical marijuana by the feds. But in fact, your efforts, the other patients' efforts, we now have 14 states.
14
that
states
either, and they're growing, and the numbers are growing, and it's shifting the opinion. And this is largely due to the efforts of,
everybody. It's the only thing I can do is talk to you, and you talk to your friends, and your friends talk to theirs, and somebody along the line talks to a doctor or a nurse, and pretty soon, we all know about it. In fact, pretty soon we all know the truth about it. And that begins to be when you see the things happening that are happening. I think I'm just a normal person. I really do. I think that you're doing the same thing. The difference is you don't have that federal license. You're right. And that does make it harder for everybody else. But it's still something that I think we all need to do.
Well, I'm always amazed because Michigan, our law passed by ballot referendum, which means the voters passed it, and in Michigan
right.
It passed with 63% of the voters supporting it.
Yeah.
Now, other states haven't established laws that way. Is there a substantial difference to our protection of our laws depending on how
you have your state in lockstep? They have done what's right by the order of the people, not because they wanted to. So the law says they have to do certain things once that's done. And that's what you have to look into, see how your state dealt with that. But, yes, that's a very good thing to start with. And the fact that the referendum made it with more than a, you know, a 1% advantage means a whole lot. Now, your politicians are listening to what 63% of the people say. They can't help it. It's by law they have to, whether they like it or not. Now, that's different. And, of course, you know you've got lots that don't like it. I can only see, you know, I can't even see how we could get politicians that can't change their minds, that can't learn. But we have a lot of them. So those will be those laws that they so stringently applied to us actually have the other side, too. And it's a much bigger myth. You got a lot more room to catch them than they had to catch you, you know. So now the point, now your point is to see how you make your state tell the DEA this is the way it is. See, the actual wording on the DEA's coverage of their drug scheduling is that marijuana is a Schedule I. It can't be used for anything. You can't possess it, have it, nothing. But in your medical, in your state medical law, it says that you can have it because the people of the state voted for it. It wasn't just something the Congress came up and said, here's what we're going to do. You can take your congressman now and say 63% of us voted for this and look up the laws that are there. Now, you have to deal with the federal government because the federal government says that in their schedule, and that's all it is, a recommendation, that it's not medical. And all we're asking is just change it from Schedule 1. We didn't even ask them to change it into any schedule. We just said, just take it out of Schedule 1. And their answer was, of course, we can't do that unless the state tells us to. So they're still saying there's no medical use in the United States until one state tells them there is. Yeah, even though there are laws on it, they're only state laws. And the feds are sticking to their, this is different. This is federal law. Even though they have no right to interfere with state law.
Okay, George, I'm being told I have a caller on the line, and who do we have here? Hello?
Hi, this is Samantha from Washington, D.C., and I have a question for our dear guest, and it's about how long have you survived since they said that you were going to die, And what was that diagnosis? I'm sorry that I might have missed your diagnosis, but I've had a lot of friends that have used medical marijuana and have had amazing results with it. And I'm just very grateful that you're here. So
thank you.
That's my question.
I applied and started applying in 88. They held it up until 90, at which point I've been in it since 1990. March of 1990. Getting close to 20 years. And I've had
And they had actually told you you were not going to survive. You were pretty much have to get your things in order. So you are not going to survive, according to doctors.
That night they had told me I wasn't going to make it through the night. That was the day they told me that. They had already told me a week before that to get my affairs in order. So I called my wife and asked her to come get me. And of course I couldn't leave. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't go to the bathroom. I couldn't eat. So they, when it all came down to it that night, I shouldn't have probably gone on. That was it, 20 years ago. And I've had other near-death experiences. While I was using marijuana, never suspecting that the marijuana had anything to do with it. But part of what my diagnosis is, for marijuana is pain, spasm, and nausea. My symptoms are no sleep. I don't eat. I can't even drink water after a while. And so that's all solved with the marijuana, as well as that pain, spasm, and nausea. Now, I started out, I was born with a misfired protein. So I am something that's programmed to run in a certain way. It's not different than the way you are, but I do look a little different. And some of my organs work different. I can't take a lot of the drugs. That's the biggest two differences. But the actual marijuana doesn't do anything to that.
The known thing about the insomnia is definitely a cured by medical marijuana. Nausea is definitely a known cure for it. So you have, and then the fact that you didn't have any kind of appetite whatsoever, that completely wipes out any possibility of a nutritional comeback of you on any scale. So,
yep.
So thank you so much.
And then add drugs
to that. I'm proud of you.
And then add drugs on top of that, strong drugs on top of that. You have a sure cure for dead people. Or a sure path for them to follow, put it that way. You're already weakened, and then you do something that weakens you more. My actual condition is nail patella syndrome. The symptoms I'm treating are from doctors treating me with drugs and surgeries, etc., for nail patella syndrome that I didn't need. The marijuana was apparently all I needed ever. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thanks, Sam. So now, George, we've addressed the medical and the fact that there are cases. You've mentioned your friend Irv, yourself, where the results have been literally miraculous, yet our government still just is ignoring the fact that this is real medicine. They were not believing the evidence of their eyes. And part of it comes from a systematic demonization of the use of marijuana starting in 1937 and progressing today, and a stereotype regarding the type of people that use marijuana. Now, go ahead.
I was agreeing with you. That's a very big problem with me, too. So, yes, please go ahead with your thought. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, one of the things is, and I understand that in addition to education as far as the medical facts of marijuana, one of the agendas of patient out of time is to redraw the face of medical marijuana patients. I don't know if I put that well. Make people realize, like you, George, you're not an old hippie just looking for an excuse to get high. You've been ill most of your life, what I understand. Is that correct?
Yeah, they'll make me as high as I want. All I got to do is tell them, and they have for most of my life.
Okay.
You know, I still have pain. Give me some more opium, okay? Some more morphine, okay?
And they were perfectly willing to supply you with drugs that we know are incredibly debilitating and addictive over a period of time. And would never discuss with you the use of marijuana. Now, see, this is one thing that I find offensive as well, because I'm a grandmother. I had illegally used the one medication that helped control my seizures effectively without, again, wonderful side effects. And every time I try to address people with, well, no, I'm not smoking just to smoke. I'm smoking because it actually helps. It's the general response is, yeah, right. And again, they tend to associate smoking marijuana with criminals or kids.
Yep, that's...
Or the old hippies. How many patients have you met over your lifetime, and you've been involved in this for a long time, that don't fit that stereotype?
I very seldom meet anybody that does. You know what? When people are poor, they have a tendency not to wear $500 shoes. You know? And that's what I usually find when you're spending your money on medications, trying to stay well, having trouble holding work, having trouble maybe doing anything, and somebody's trying to give you more drugs or more treatment that make you less able to do that. I find people do often lose care for their world. And that doesn't mean because you grow your hair longer you don't shave. That means that actual particular description you're giving me, it makes so much sense to me. You know, and I hope this makes sense to you guys. It is usually a person's dress demeanor that is the first thing other people will pick up on. Okay? First opinion is always the one that's right. So when I see somebody walking down the street, I've made it. And it's hard to do. I try not to make a decision on who that might be. I try simply to say, I might be an interesting person. If I treat them with the same respect that I just treated the banker with, I'll bet you I find an interesting person. And generally, I find humans are interesting. But when you try to judge them by your values, then you often have trouble. Doesn't mean you can't. You have to judge people by your values, but it just means you can't instantly do it and then hold that opinion, because often people are not what they seem.
Now, you're not real shy about speaking up on behalf of medical marijuana. I know this for a fact from many discussions with you, but fill in some of the places that you've testified or spoken out, not just within the United States, but you've been active in this at a lot of different levels and a lot of different places. Would you be willing to fill in some of that? You don't have to sound like you're bragging. We understand.
Yeah. I've been in every one of your senators' offices, other than the few that have been elected since the last time I was there. I wouldn't testify to the Senate. That many of them all at once scared me. Irvin did that. I have, of course, delivered all kinds of paperwork and petitions to him. I've been to Europe. We traveled all over Europe. Again, universities and government operations. And what was the most fun was for instance, Holland, it's legal. It's not legal, excuse me. It's tolerated. And there's people growing pot plants in their front window. There's people with apartments that's all they do in them. And so we got a real tour. When we got there, everybody was talking, how high can you get? When we left, they were talking, wow, this stuff does more than just makes you high. And we're all for investigating any kind of a strain that might do just that. So it's been all over at least the Western world. I haven't been in any Eastern areas. And in fact, when I wanted to go to Australia, Australia wouldn't allow it. I had invitations from 5 universities to come down there and lecture, and they wouldn't even talk to me about it. So I haven't been to Australia yet, but I was more than a little afraid to go there. They, it seems to me, if I remember correctly, they all have to stop for fuel in Asia. And I did not want to be in Asia with, my supply of medical marijuana on me. And so I've been all over lots of people's offices that you would probably know if you're from there.
No, that's true. Now, when you travel, you carry your supply with you. What's it like going through customs carrying a half a pound or a pound of marijuana?
Well, it depends. Sometimes they'll let me take it, sometimes they won't. Canada told me to bring it after they told me, the federal health minister told me, it's no problem, you can come to Canada. Do you have to bring your marijuana? It'd be easier if you didn't. And we know plenty of people can get it for you. And so I had to sit down and explain to him the difference between smoking one joint of this today and one joint of that tomorrow, and that really didn't continue the actual medication that I was looking for. Like, I wouldn't take morphine today and methamphetamine tomorrow. You know, that there was that maybe not that much difference, but there could, and there has been that much difference for me. So I prefer just to smoke, even though it's not considered good by anybody. It's really good medicine. So I just prefer just to smoke that. And the Canadian health minister actually was just more than happy to help me come to Canada. Now, we don't always get that reception. Sometimes they'll tell me you can come, but don't bring your medicine, period. And then for 5 or 6 weeks, in Holland for 6 weeks, I had they have security. It's like not like a secret police, but it is. Okay. They don't like to be called that. And when I finally met the head of their whatever level department that is, I guess it's a federal department, he came to my door one morning and knocked on the door and came in to sit down and talk to me because he hadn't seen the normal behavior that he thought he would see from somebody, from a group of people. I took 5 patients with me too. And he had not seen the kind of behavior that he expected from Americans talking about marijuana openly and loudly in Holland. So he came down and talked to me, and he says, well, come out here with me. He goes, you see that car down there? Do you recognize it? I said, well, it's a little blue car. And I said, well, yeah. And he goes, well, there'll always be 2 guys somewhere around it or in it. He goes, those are my guys, and they were watching you, and now they're watching out for you. And I thought, now that's, yeah, boom, that's pretty cool. You went from an enemy to a supporter that quick.
Well, I've seen that as well. Once people meet patients face-to-face and talk to them and realize that, oh, this is the guy down the block, or this could be my grandmother or my uncle or my
grandson.
That's somebody that I would like to mention just briefly is Grandma May Nutt, who was one of also the original board members of Patients Out of Time. She was active in pushing for medical marijuana starting in the late 1970s, as I recall correctly. You can stop me if I'm wrong. But
she's been around a long time.
And she got into it not for herself, but when her son was suffering from, I believe, cancer. And
cancer.
And at a time when it was not even beginning to be talked about, because she was a mom and this was her son.
Yep. She and Bob Randall talked quite a bit through the 80s. But they would do college seminars and stuff, which helped. I mean, it got the word out to start. By the 90s, of course, then others of us were joining. And so we were just joining May Night. She'd been out there for a long time.
Yeah, she was an amazing lady, and like I said, because it wasn't that something she was doing for herself, but to relieve the suffering of someone she cared about. And in our laws, it's written to protect family members who are trying to assist someone who is ill and getting medicine. They call it the caregiver law. If you're designated in getting medicine for someone else, you're protected as well.
That was the main point with her, whenever they would come to tear up his plants, she'd say, they're not his plants, they're mine. I'm growing them for him. but he's not growing them. It's pretty strange what people will do to control you.
Well, our government is amazing in the level it has gone to bar the use of marijuana, but this was a plant that's been around for thousands of years with no known difficulties.
Yeah, you can't overdose on it. You can on opium. That's legal. all the extracts from opium are legal. In fact, until last week, all of the compounds in marijuana except THC Delta 9 were legal. Actually, I think the natural still is in Iowa. It's the strangest set of stall tactics I've ever seen. They can come up with any excuse in one witness, and that puts it off for another year. And that's all they care about. Get me to the election time and through that.
Now, at one point in time, wasn't one of the DEA's own administrative judges sent forth a ruling that...
Oh, 1988. Yep. Judge Marion Arino? No, I'm sorry, Francis Young. Sorry about the name confusion. Francis Young issued a statement, and he was 88 years old. He wasn't a young pup. He was retired, and he did an administrative judge means he takes all the evidence for the agency and then makes a decision and tells the agency what he's decided. So it isn't really like going to court. It's a decision, but it's not a legal binding decision. And he at that point said marijuana is the most is one of the safest compounds. No, it's not even compounds. Plant and medical material known to man. That it is, I mean, he was saying it is medicine. That it's not only safe; it's good for you.
Okay. Yeah, I remember that something along those lines coming up during the course of, like I said, I've gone through the Patients Out of Time website any number of times. Now, during the course of this, again, now we're up to 14 states legalized. I asked you at one point how many it would take, and you said just one, and you've already gone over that. It's going to require one of our states, any state, suing the feds to change the schedule and then sue the feds to do the same. Am I understanding that process correct?
Just the DEA. They just have to, just the DEA has to change their scheduling.
Okay, now can the DEA change scheduling without going through Congress? Can Congress force the DEA to change the scheduling?
That would be an interesting question to see in court. I haven't gotten that far yet to think about it. I'm not sure. I suspect, of course, they could. However, that was what I was mentioning about the, under the drug laws, the states have their own sovereignty in the drug laws. Okay, they can schedule any drug, any schedule they want, and the feds can't interfere. Now, they can come in and do things on a federal level. If you have a pound, they can come take you to jail. You know, sales of a pound, that's enough to get you. But as far as state limits, is like if the state says you can have a pound, then you're not supposed to be able to be bothered by the feds, of course, now because our president has said so. However, when we try to look up what he said, it's not in writing anywhere. So there's some other stuff. There's some other stuff in there that leads us to believe that he meant it, but at the same time, you're dealing with an agency, not an elected group. This is just an agency, and they don't have the right to overcome a state, but we know what they do. They break the rules, and then they say, well, you're supposed to follow these. Then they never bother to explain that, no, you don't have to follow them. And maybe they do. I mean, maybe our politicians, and most of them that I've met are just so weak-kneed, willy. You know, they're confused. You walk up and meet them, and you throw your hand out to shake their hand and say hi, and you can just see their eyes clouded over. Well, they're stoned out of their minds. I know it. Purple noses, bright red veins in their cheeks. You know, come on. And it may be medication. It may be booze. It may just be their own butt smell, you know. Whatever they call it when you get high on being the one in power. But whatever it is, it simply doesn't make a lot of sense for them to say we have to do this because they don't. And it's very well spelled out in the DEA's bylaws that they don't have to do it. You know, it says you make the rules up the way you want them federally. But if a state follows them or not, that's up to the state. And then, of course, then the feds say, oh, yeah, but we can come in if it violates our law if we want to. So...
Okay, but I'm going to jump in here now. I believe we have another caller on the line.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello, this is Mike from Hawaii. I have a question for the guest. I was wondering if he thought that as soon as marijuana, if it ever is legalized nationally, that will be the point when corporations jump in and start taking over everything.
Yes, I do. besides the medical use of the plant, it makes so many other things that the whole plant's usable, why would they stop there? And of course, there's going to be a lot of money in who comes up with the distributable form. And I believe they just removed one of the blockades for that too, although I don't want to say it now, so I'll drop it, excuse me. When we finally overcome this, first it'll be I'm sure coming right in now are the pharmaceutical companies. They're the ones fighting hardest to keep it out. They're most likely the ones that are going to profit the most from it. Otherwise, they're going to lose a lot of money. So you can get the idea that besides taxes and the corporations jumping in, the price will stay reasonable if we just allow it that way. Then, no, it's not. It's going to go up. You know, and they're right now, they're getting, geez, $200 a quarter ounce, $600 a quarter ounce. It's just insane. If patients can't afford that, you know, people that make $300, $400, $500 a month and pay doctor bills from that. So that's part of what I'm worried about too, is that the corporate and the actual tax interest that's being shown now. I'm personally, let somebody grow it for you, or if you can grow it yourself, grow it in the backyard. If your doctor and you agree that you need it, and you're still able to grow it, why would that matter? You know, it's like, well, you got to be too sick to grow it yourself, or you can't. You know, so those are things that are worrying me. I don't want the corporates in it at all, because they'll ruin it. They'll go for all the things that you hear now. Oh, more THC is better. Well, hate to tell you this, but THC does one thing. It is the hallucinogenic part of marijuana. It is the part that gives you the trip. Now, is it bad for you? No. Does it hurt you? No. Do people all handle it well? No.
No, we're both here. I think we lost Mike, though.
Okay.
That led into something else, because you and I have discussed the actual cost of growing marijuana. Now, as I said, for many years, I went ahead and did what I needed to do for my health. But I was paying street prices. Now, since my state has legalized, I've been hearing some these compassionate people charging $280 to $340 per ounce of weed because they state it's medical grade. Can you talk to us about what you think is the real cost to grow medical grade marijuana?
I know what it is. I don't care what kind of marijuana you grow. You can grow it for 50 cents a gram. It's fact. And anything you do over that, you have not done the plant any good. Everything you're doing is making it easy for you, and that doesn't mean I should have to pay for that. But every plant you can grow now, you can grow without all the extras. And so it's about 50 cents a gram.
Which
that price
comes to $14 an ounce.
Yeah, $14 an ounce. And I know, because I've experienced it. I've gone where they do it. And of course I had to leave my country to do it, but that was walking right into the grower or the store, however they had the supply set up, and buying it. And it wasn't a matter of what grade did I want. It was because it's all grown the same way. That some people spend more time on theirs. That's their own personal, likes and dislikes. And in fact, I would want somebody that spends more time on it. And they deserve to make more than 50 cents a gram, because that's what it costs. But do they deserve to make $175 a quarter ounce? No. That makes millionaires in weeks. And in fact, some of the states that have legalized, people that I've known as regular people are now regular, very rich people. And you know, that even changes them. They seem to go, the more they make, the more they want to make.
See, now legalization has been very recent in Michigan, and one of the things we do have is the right to grow our own or designate another person to grow for us. And most patients seem to prefer that option for a number of reasons. Number one, the cost. Because I said, I saw the street price, or, you know, I can still get it on the street here in Michigan for $140 an ounce. That's 10 times the cost that you just cited to grow it. But that's been pretty standard for a long time while it was illegal. But for medical grade, it has jumped to double that and more. And so obviously most patients are priced right out of the market. Just like me, you smoke 8 ounces a month. I smoke about 3. So that would put me at right around $1,000 a month for medication, and a medication, and a medication that my insurance company is not going to cover. They're basically going to laugh me out of the room. So a lot of people are still trapped into, even where they have legal access, they're still trapped into the pharmaceuticals because that's what their insurance will cover. Have you seen any efforts to convince the insurance companies to cover medical marijuana in the places it's legal?
No. And the only thing positive I've heard about it at all was Progressive Insurance, the major stockholder or whoever has major control is in support of it. That's the only positiveness I have about that field, period.
Now, I heard that homeowner insurance here in Michigan are covering losses to patients who, if their home is broken into, they lose their plants. It's being covered under homeowner's insurance.
Excellent.
Has that occurred anywhere else, or is Michigan just trying to get ahead of the curve since we were behind in the first place?
Not that I've heard of, but that doesn't mean it hasn't happened, just that I haven't heard of it.
Well, like I said, these cases are fairly recent. Also, Michigan Supreme Court also made a ruling. You were the first to tell me about it, even though I'm from Michigan. So I'll let you tell the audience about it.
Oh, no, I forgot which one.
The one in reference to the metabolites no longer being justification for an arrest for impaired driving.
DUI now in Michigan, they no longer can test you for metabolites. That's what marijuana is. It's garbage. When it's done, when it goes through your system, there are metabolites left. That just says that it was there. And what they've done up until now, that's why everybody says, well, THC stays in your body 30 to 45 days. No, it doesn't. The metabolites, what's left over, goes into your fat, and it naturally washes out just like any other metabolite. So that particular one could be there as long as 45 days. And now in Michigan, that's no longer evidence of incapacitated operation. You have to have some reason to have pulled that person over and tested them. So they're not showing intoxication. They're not.
That's important to patients because essentially being impaired just based on the metabolites barred any patient from driving.
That's right. Yep. Except so me, mine has a script law.
You have a
as
what
long
law?
As I'm under the script law. As long as I don't show signs of intoxication, I'm on illegal medicine, and it's not illegal for me to drive. Yeah.
Okay, but that the states, that doesn't apply in each of the states that have legalized to their patients within their state.
No. No, in fact, there are a lot of them are passing laws, even after the DOT has said, people that smoke marijuana drive better, period. They've done it twice now. The federal truck enforcement, you know, says that people smoke pot, they're better, they're safer drivers. They're more likely not to drive, first of all. They're more likely to drive slow, second of all. And third, their reflexes slow down, that goes along with their slow driving. So do their actions. In other words, if the speed limit's 55, and you think you're too stoned, you'll probably pull over. If you think you are stoned, you'll probably drive 50. You know, enough to keep up with traffic, and yet to have that limited, that whatever limit there is to, and a person who doesn't smoke regularly will have those. You know, you'll have lapses. Also changing your strain every other week is another reason why people have lapses, because they're getting adjusted to that. So that's not fair, you know, to call people high because they have metabolites.
Okay. And, I've lost the question. I was just going to ask you because it was relative to this, and it went right out of my head. Only have a short amount of time left, and we were talking about the metabolites and the ability to drive. Now,
correct.
Are there studies on this? Have they done, because you and I have talked about the fact that, I know what it was. I was thinking about all the people who've been killed by drunk drivers and the people who've died from medical mistakes and overdoses of medication. George, how many people have died as a direct result of either using marijuana or in any way, shape, or form, and the reward that's up in regards to this?
None that I know of. ever have died from the use of marijuana or as a complication. I won't say that's a fact, just as far as I know, and I look for that kind of stuff, so I would guess none. Second of all, the reward. Now I lost track. See what you did to me, Tom? I guess I don't quite understand what part of the reward you mean. There is a reward for the cops. You know, the more numbers they get, then they prefer patients. They're easy to arrest.
I'm talking about the gentleman who put up the $10,000 for the first person who comes forward to absolute proof of a death due to marijuana.
Oh yeah, Jack Hare. Jack Hare did that. In fact, I think it's gone to $100,000. It's huge. There's nobody can do it. They can't show it that it happens. At best, if you drop a 1,500-pound bale from 10 foot above a person, it would be about 2% less likely to kill them than a bale of cotton, because the cotton is packed tighter.
Okay. So then this reward is up, never been claimed, yet they're still saying
never
that marijuana is incredibly... And you don't think that if somebody had that proof, $10,000 and now $100,000 is quite a temptation.
But think of this. When the government offers a contract to prove something about marijuana, they don't offer a contract for $500,000 to say what marijuana does. They offer $500,000 to some, I'm not going to say what I think of these folks, to some person to say what they want them to say. So if they want it to kill people, well, in fact, Dr. Nahas is a perfect example. The U.S. government supported his investigations and studies completely. They paid him. But when he finished writing them, and this is to the tune of several million dollars, he was on this for 10 or 15 years. When he finished writing them, they were able to take one sentence that they could make sound bad. One sentence. And that was, it kills brain cells. Now, what the whole sentence says was, when you smother a monkey and you cut his brain off immediately upon his heart ceasing to beat, he'll have dead brain cells. Obviously not because his heart stopped beating. But he forgot to say, when they published the report, they forgot to say that smothering does that to you.
Yeah,
you got blood.
It causes
right.
blood vessels to burst in the eyes and all kinds of wonderful things. Well, we're
correct.
Running on time, George. So, is there anything that I have forgot to mention that you feel is very important for people to know? You've got 2 minutes to sum it up.
Yes, to know as much as they can about medical use and to call your senator, state and federal. Call them both. You need to call them and tell them you support that. You don't have to get angry. Just call them and say, support these issues. They're important, and I'm worried about them, and I'm a voter, whether you are or not. I mean, I always recommend you vote. We got to keep that number up. So
yeah,
register to
vote.
Yeah,
that's how we got passed in Michigan was the voters. If we'd have waited for our government, we'd still be waiting.
You'd still be waiting. You just never know when it'll come in handy, so it's good to do. You can force the government, you guys. There are laws on the books that work both ways. They can make me do what they want. I can make them do what I want. And I can make them quit doing to me what they want quicker than they can make me quit doing to them. And I don't have any prisons.
And you've been very effective. So, you know, like I said,
from
a new patient to one of the original patients, I realize that everybody who is benefiting from medical marijuana now has a debt of gratitude to you and your fellow patients, people who once you were realized what you had there were standing up for the rest of us. And hopefully we will start standing up now because the numbers are growing. 16,000 registered in Michigan in 15 months.
Yeah, over 1,000 a month. That's not bad. That's showing them what really is important.
And that's telling them the need is there and people want this as medicine.
Yeah, and not everybody wants it. That was another argument you had, was everybody wants it because they just want to get high. Well, no. In fact, after a while, you don't get high, do you?
No, I haven't been high. I can't, when people tell me, oh, I get so stoned, I'm like, how do you do that? I don't know what that means.
people tell me to smoke better. When I did, it made no difference. But I'm already saturated. There's nothing you can give me to make me any higher unless I, you know, I suffocate myself, then I'll get rushes. I can do that. But the other thing is, you can turn off everything else and turn on the good feeling. That's the point. I can feel as good as I want, but I don't relate that to being high.
No, there's a substantial difference for how a patient experiences it and a person that is smoking for recreational purposes. And I don't think we can ever communicate that across until someone has a medical need and understands that difference.
There's a difference. I think they all have a medical need or they wouldn't do it. It's integral to life. It has been for thousands of years. All of a sudden, we decided not to use it, and we have the kind of things going on that we have. Doesn't that give you a hint? Does me.
Well, I find it interesting that we have cannabinoid receptors in the brain, and cannabis is a source of cannabinoids. And why would we have these receptors in our brain if we weren't not supposed to be used this?
That's correct. Yeah, more in women than men. Did you know that?
No, I didn't realize that. So now I've learned something new tonight.
Yep. You are extra cannabinoid receptors in your reproduction area. They have way more than men. It's a real strange thing. I mean, men still have a huge number of them. It's more than any other receptor in the body. And that one particular arrangement is just the difference between how many men and women have. Women have the most. It may give us a hint, too.
Okay, well, George, we're out of time, and we're running over, and
thank you, thank you, thank you.
And thank you, George, for the time tonight.